It used to have an intro. I just remembered I haven't done that for a while. Welcome. Oh, don't start that now.
The CMU Podcast, in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Ardio, Radiohead, MCPS and Beyonce. Welcome to the CMU Podcast, the week in the music business. In under 60 minutes, all your money back. Was that the intro I used to say before I was off ill?
You said it once.
Well, that's good enough.
I think to suggest that that was some sort of slogan that we used on a regular basis would be a lie.
Yeah.
I mean, you were prepared of changing the slogan every week, but that was definitely our slogan on the one week that the podcast was over an hour, if I remember rightly. The only time in history that our podcast has been over an hour was the week that you said that.
It was about 1 second over. Anyway, I'm Andy Malt, editor of CMU.
You are.
My guest.
I can vouch for that. He is Andy Malt, editor of CMU.
My guest this week is Chris Cook. He also does something at CMU.
I do.
I forget what.
Things. Look me up on the internet.
I have no health warning at the beginning of this week's podcast.
What was last week's health warning?
Tinnitus last week.
Oh, that was right.
Flu the week before. But
stick fluff in your ears last week.
I've had no health problems this week.
Jab, flu. But, well, obviously the big health warning of the week was not to follow the Smiths Twitter feed. You don't want to do that.
No, that could perilous.
Says Morrissey. Bad things will happen if you follow the Twitter feed that Warner Music have had the audacity to set up, presumably because they're doing some re-releases of Smith's
stuff. I assume
stuff.
So. They've not really done anything with the thing yet.
I can't quite remember where the Smith's catalogue ended up. Did it end up with Warner? Who knows? Who knows what's going on there?
Who knows where anyone's catalogue is, as we'll discuss later.
As we will discuss later. But Morrissey would not like you to follow him on Twitter. I'm still recovering from what I think historians are going to call, in the future, Tech Fail Wednesday, which affected me this week.
Affected me?
It did affect you. When my
side effect.
When my laptop battery died. And that doesn't sound like a big deal, but it was quite a big deal in the CMU headquarters. And somehow, and we're still to work out exactly whose fault this was, but as a result of the battery fail on Tech Fail Wednesday, we lost half the CMU Daily just as it was about to be published on Wednesday morning. Still can't remember whose fault that was. Something happened somewhere along the lines. And that kind of ruined my Wednesday.
Yeah, it was very early on Wednesday as well.
It was. It's really a bad start to Wednesday. Fortunately, we're recording this on Thursday. So the stress of Tech Fail Wednesday won't impact on this week's podcast. And then I did my piracy session over at IE Music on Wednesday. I recovered from Tech Fail Wednesday.
And then you went and did some piracy.
I went to talk about the music industry's long-running campaign against online piracy from a litigation legal context point of view. And it was good. If I say so myself, because it was new. I'd never actually done that session in that order before. So it was a brand new training. Most of my training sessions I've done 82 times before, and I know exactly what I'm going to say when I get there, whereas that was brand new. So if you would like me to come and talk about music piracy in your offices for 2 hours one afternoon, who wouldn't want that?
I'm all right, thanks.
And I'll show up with a laptop with no battery. And I will show you my slides. Then go to cmuinsights.com and it will tell you how you can hire us. Little plug there. We've got lots of events coming up. You go to cmuinsights.com, you'll find out about them. We are making some Great Escape announcements. As this podcast goes out, we'll be revealing a few more speakers on the two strands we've already announced. So our YouTube strand and our data and transparency strand. We announced the headlines of those strands a few weeks ago. We're going to announce a whole load more speakers who are taking part on those strands. And then next week...
Yes...
we're going to announce details about the other two strands.
Ooh.
The mysterious strands that we haven't really said much about to date. So lots of Great Escape news, CMU. There's been lots of Great Escapes news. I'm talking about CMU Insights at the Great Escape news in the next 10 days, on top of all of the many other bits of Great Escape news that have been breaking in recent times. No health warnings this week, just an awful lot of plugging at the start of the podcast. I wasn't even planning that. I just naturally plug. I'm a natural plugger.
It's just who you are.
I don't need it scripted. I don't need PR people preparing it for me. You turn on the microphone and I plug. So there you go. That's what I do at CMU. I'm plugger in chief.
It's a shame, really, because I had quite a good segue into the first
story,
and then you went off on your plugging thing. And
segue from what? Something I said.
Well, I was going to say, I'll tell you what ruined Anthony Bay from Ardio's Wednesday. Well, I don't think this actually happened on Wednesday.
So you're relating to my Tech Fail Wednesday and it ruining my, and to a certain extent, your day.
Yeah, now I've sort of made that segue anyway. So let's talk about Sony Music suing three former RDO executives, including Anthony Bay, the ex-CEO.
This could be my favourite lawsuit of the year. There's lots about this lawsuit.
It's a bold claim.
That could be quite fun. So I suppose it requires a very quick recap. RDO was a streaming service. Do people remember that? There was this streaming service called RDO.
It was like Spotify, but no one used it.
It was like Spotify, and a few people used it, mainly who worked at RDO, but they loved it. The people who loved at RDO The people who lived at RDO loved it. They lived there and they loved I don't know. RDO staff were fans of their service. It was a streaming service. It no longer exists. Late last year, in November time, RDO went bankrupt. But it was quite a peculiar announcement, wasn't it? Because it was, RDO has been bought by Pandora, was the headline.
And also is bankrupt, by the way.
And is going bankrupt. So it was sort of, that was how the news was presented. So yes, Pandora bought RDO, but it didn't buy RDO. It bought RDO's assets. Because Pandora, which is obviously the personalised radio service in the US, we know has ambitions to launch a fully-fledged on-demand streaming service. Because they're struggling to make money out of their personalised radio services. And we all know how easy it is to make money out of on-demand streaming services, because no one's done that. But I suppose having two loss-making services, one can keep the other company, I guess. So Pandora have ambitions to launch an on-demand streaming service, which is why they were interested in buying RDO. They wanted RDO's know-how. They probably wanted a bit of RDO's platform and technology. But what they didn't want was the $220 million in debts.
No, it's not a very attractive option.
They didn't want them. So they went to RDO and they said, well, we'll buy your knowledge and we'll buy some of your technology. And they took on quite a few of RDO's staff, what is sometimes in startup circles called an acqui-hire, another term I'm sure you love.
Yep.
But we won't buy the company outright as a going concern because we don't want to take on all of those 200 million plus liabilities. And we're not actually that interested in acquiring RDO's users. The main reason for taking RDO as a going concern would be if they actually wanted to take on the subscribers who had signed up to RDO. But there was two things of that, which is A, Pandora were not planning to immediately launch their on-demand service. So they didn't really need customers from day one because there would be a gap between RDO stopping and the new service beginning. Also, there weren't many RDO subscribers, so they weren't particularly interested in that. Hence this deal where they bought the assets of RDO, and as part of the deal, RDO agreed to then bankrupt the company, so wipe clean most of its debts, and then out of the bankruptcy, Pandora would then buy the assets. And they paid about $75 million, I think.
Yes.
So $75 million would go in as part of that asset purchase. So the people overseeing the bankruptcy of RDO could then decide how to divvy that money up between the creditors of RDO, which included various people who had pumped money into the business, had loaned money into the business, but it also included the record companies.
Yes.
Which brings us to this week's litigation.
Because while all those negotiations that you were talking about there were going on, there were some other negotiations going on, including Sony Music renegotiating its licenses with RDO. And in its lawsuit, Sony alleges that these three execs, so Anthony Bay,
who was CEO,
the general counsel Elliot Peters and head of licensing Jim Rondinelli.
Why not?
they all misled Sony Music in those negotiations. It is claimed, mainly, they said that Sony should allow them to put off paying $5.5 million it owed in minimum guarantee licensing royalties for a bit because, hey, everything's going fine, just don't have the cash spare right now. Sony claims they sort of implied that they were raising new funding.
I think they say that they were told that explicitly.
Yeah, Sony went, all right, you're raising new funding, you'll get the $5.5 million off you later. Next thing they know, Pandora has bought bits of RDO. RDO is bankrupt and Sony is out in the cold.
It is, because Sony was an unsecured creditor. So RDO had both secured creditors and unsecured creditors. What that means is when the company goes bankrupt, but there are assets left to be sold, the $75 million they made from the Pandora sale, the secured creditors will get paid first. So it means the secured creditors, they probably wouldn't have seen all of their money because that was still about $170, $180 million of secured debt. And there was only $75 million to go round, assuming there weren't any other pockets of money around, which there might have been, I don't know. So the secured creditors wouldn't be getting all of their money back, but they would see a lot more money than the unsecured creditors. So yes, Sony was renegotiating its licensing deal, and the $5.5 million was the minimum guarantees. So we've talked about how streaming deals work before on the podcast. They are ultimately revenue share arrangements. So if you're setting up a new RDO, Sony will do you a deal where you have to pay them about 60% of your revenue based on their consumption. But there are always these minimum guarantees. So they will say, OK, we'll do it on a 60% rev share, but we want $1 million a year, $2 million a year, guaranteed. So whatever happens, even if it turns out you've only got 9 subscribers, so that's 60% of, you know, whatever that would be, $90 a month, you have to pay us $1 million, $2 million, whatever. And that's where the $5.5 million came from. They hadn't paid those minimum guarantees to Sony, but as you say, as part of the negotiations to renew the Sony licensing deal, well, what Sony are alleging is that basically RDO management was saying, everything's fine, we're in it for the long haul. As you say, they implied that they were raising more money, which would help RDO continue for a few more years, despite being loss-making, help RDO pay off some of the debts that it has to Sony. And then the next thing they knew, they went into bankruptcy. And of course, it turned out that the negotiations with Pandora, which were conditional on the bankruptcy to remove the liabilities, had been going on at the same time as Sony.
Yes. So Sony is saying that not only did the execs there know full well that RDO was likely to be out of business in the very near future and prior to having to pay this $5.5 million, Anthony Bay himself stood to gain because he was one of the secured creditors of the company.
Yes, so he is an owner and director of another company that had lent money, I think, to RDO, but they were one of the secured creditors. So you're right. The allegation is it was in Anthony Bay's interest to allow the Pandora deal to go through, even though that meant that the company he was running was going to go bankrupt, but he personally would profit from that as a secured creditor who would get a cut of that $75 million, knowing that as a result of that arrangement, Sony would see, well, pennies in a dollar from the $5.5 million that they were owed, which is why they are suing. Obviously, they can't sue RDO because RDO no longer exists. They can't sue Pandora because they don't have a relationship with Pandora, but they're suing the individuals. And basically what they seem to want is the money Anthony Bay made as a result of the Pandora deal, the bankruptcy, the asset sale. They want that money. So they're basically saying that man over there, he shouldn't have got that money. That was sneaky. That was dodgy. We should have the cash. He may have spent it by now. I don't know. Presumably they're hoping that he hasn't spent it yet. We should have that money as a contribution towards the $5.5 million of minimum guarantees we didn't receive. As far as I'm aware, the three targeted guys are yet to respond. So it'll be interesting to see how they respond, whether or not any settlement can be done, and whether this will go to court. And as we say, if cases like this do go to court, it will be fascinating because it will give us a lot more insight as to what exactly was going on at RDO in the sort of the months or probably year when it was basically heading towards closure and they were winding the operation down. But what was going behind the scenes and what were they telling their label partners and the collecting societies and the publishers who represent the song rights? What was going on there? So if it was to get to court, we might find that out.
It won't, though. It'll be settled.
Oh, it'll be settled.
They always settle.
They always settle. But anyway, for now, an interesting bit of litigation. Sony Music versus Blast from the Past, RDO.
As alluded to in the introduction earlier, Radiohead's catalogue is all over the place at the moment. Who knows where it is? Well, we do. It's at Excel. The end. Move on.
That's the end of this section.
Yeah.
And in some ways, it bringing together all the different Radiohead albums. I'm not quite sure where In Rainbow sits. Actually, I think that's Excel as well.
Yeah.
Certainly the more recent one is Excel. So this is a move that has seemingly brought all of the Radiohead albums into one label's catalogue rather than it being split between two different labels, which is what it was until this week.
Yes, but how has that happened? It started earlier this week. Some people, I think on Reddit, where all things now happen, noticed that some Radiohead B-sides had gone missing from streaming services.
And particularly Spotify.
Particularly Spotify, and which some people naturally assumed was Thom Yorke taking another stand against Spotify.
Yeah,
although,
Thom Yorke.
Why he'd do that by just removing B-sides is a bit weird.
Yeah, but Thom Yorke, obviously a pioneer when it comes to Spotify dissing. The other Spotify dissers came after Thom Yorke and him dissing the streaming business model.
I'm not sure he was the first.
Well, maybe not the first, but one of the first really high-profile artists to get a lot of coverage for being down on the streaming music model. So that was why people naturally assumed when Radiohead tracks started to disappear that perhaps this was something was happening behind the scenes. He was taking a stand. Although, as you say, why now? It was a couple of years ago now, maybe 3 years ago now, that Thom Yorke was dissing Spotify and slagging off Spotify, and why only the B-sides? And also, the assumption was that the reason why Radiohead's catalogue remained on Spotify throughout, despite Thom Yorke being quite a high-profile critic of streaming services, especially Spotify, was because actually he didn't control the original Radiohead catalogue, because the band were originally signed to EMI back in the day, and they stopped working with EMI when their first record contract ended. But because by that point EMI was owned by the private equity guys at Terra Firma, who Radiohead didn't get on with very well, I think it's fair to say, they just had stopped working with EMI, but the EMI as was continue to control the catalogue. And then when EMI got sold, actually Warner ended up with the Parlophone catalogue, of which the Radiohead albums were part of. So Warner controlled the catalogue. So actually it wasn't up to Thom Yorke and Radiohead as to whether or not those albums were on Spotify. It was up to the bosses at Warner. So yes, that was probably, I mean, I've not seen their record deal. Sometimes artists have a veto. So even though they don't own or control the copyrights in their recordings, they can still veto which services those recordings stream on. But as far as I'm aware, that wasn't in Radiohead original EMI contract. And so however angry Thom Yorke may have been about streaming services over recent years, he never had the power to just pull the Radiohead catalogue from there. So if he was suddenly removing B-sides, well, A, why just the B-sides? And B, what has changed to give Thom Yorke that power? But it sort of turns out, well, this is still actually to be properly confirmed, but everybody and a few sources have confirmed it unofficially. Everyone seems to think that something has happened that doesn't actually give Thom Yorke power over his records, but likewise means that Warner Music no longer have the power over those recordings either.
Yes, as you alluded to, when it went through the motions, competition regulators made Universal get rid of a few of the assets that it was trying to buy, one of which being Parlophone, which was spun off into its own separate company and then sold to Warner. But the indie labels, having very much opposed EMI's sale to Universal, were quite ready to oppose Parlophone's sale to Warner until Warner went and did a deal and said, look, guys, if you let this go through without a fuss, we'll sell you some bits and you can just have them. It'll be great. Just calm down.
Yeah, because there was that.
And that's where we are now. This is what this is.
This is the calming down bit.
Yes.
Because there had been a whole period after EMI had been split up into label and publishing, and then Universal had been sold EMI. But because, as you say, European regulators had said, you've got to sell off some of it. Parlophone was the biggest bit. It was Parlophone minus the Beatles, let's remember. The most important bit of Parlophone wasn't part of that. And as you say, there was that year, more or less, where Universal carved off the bits it was being forced to sell and put it into its own company, and then it started merging the rest of EMI with Universal. And so you then have the Parlophone label group, which was Parlophone and a handful of other things. And there was a period where various indies, the bigger indies, were expressing an interest in taking bits of the Parlophone catalogue or maybe certain albums and certain releases. Then Warner swooped in, did the deal, and as you say, because that also needed regulator approval to ensure that the sale of Parlophone to Warner wasn't also scuppered in some way by the European regulators. It was Impala, the pan-European indie label trade body, and also Merlin, the organisation that represents a lot of indies in digital on a worldwide basis, brokered this deal, and Warner committed that once they owned Parlophone, that they would divest up to about a third, and that's a third in terms of value rather than quantity, but up to about a third of the Parlophone catalogue, they would offload onto indies. Offload's a negative word, isn't it? They would reward, sell,
well,
or
especially
license.
Because they've gone with Radiohead, which was
another prize of that repertoire. So yes, they said, once we've done the deal, once we control Parlophone, we will allow indie labels to represent about a third of the Parlophone catalogue by value, either by actually selling off chunks of the catalogue, so small chunks that realistically no indie could have afforded to buy the entirety of Parlophone, but we'll sell it off in little chunks so that the bigger indies realistically could afford. Or we might just do licensing deals or distribution deals. So we'll still ultimately keep the copyright, but we'll allow indie labels to represent it. They made that commitment before the acquisition. Shortly after the acquisition, after 2014, I think, a statement came out saying, we're sticking to that, it's going to happen, we're going to start the motion. And then we didn't really hear anything for 2 years.
And then Radiohead's B-side started disappearing.
Yeah, then Radiohead's B-side started disappearing. And actually, a couple of months ago, there were rumours that it had taken a long time to negotiate these deals, but they were now being signed off. And it seems that XL, which, as I mentioned, have been working with Radiohead and actually Thom Yorke as a solo artist since the end of the original EMI Radiohead deal, releasing the more subsequent albums. It seems that XL, who one assumes is sitting on quite a large pile of cash. Well, we knew they were anyway, but the last lot of figures we had from the Beggars Group, who own most of XL, were pre the most recent Adele album. So the big pile of cash we already knew XL were sitting on must now be a mountain of cash as a result of all of those Adele record sales. So presumably they do have a little bit of money. I mean, we don't know whether this is a purchase or a licensing deal, but they presumably have quite a lot of money. And it would make sense for XL to take over Radiohead. Well, I would assume that this would be very popular with the band themselves, because they have voluntarily worked with XL on recent albums. Tom York has worked with XL on a couple of albums, so I assume that they will be really pleased that they now get to work with a Beggars label on their catalogue rather than their catalogue sitting with Warner Music.
Yes, but why the B-sides? We should probably get to that point. It's
well, why the B-sides?
I think we've probably built it up.
Why just the B-sides?
Why the B-sides? Because the B-sides were actually bonus tracks on reissues of the albums.
I mentioned that Radiohead's record contract with EMI reached an end. At that point, Terra Firma, this private equity company, took over EMI, which was still a standalone major company at the time, fired everybody. So all the people that Tom York and Radiohead and their management knew and liked suddenly weren't there anymore. And they didn't do another duel with EMI. There was quite a bit of bad blood between the major and the band. And it sort of felt like it was just to piss the band off. But I'm sure there was some clever strategic reason. EMI, as was under Terra Firma's management, then put out all these special editions of the original albums. And the band were quite clear at the time: we are in no way involved in these reissues of our albums. We're not happy that they're happening. So I suppose that is presumably why now friendly XL are seemingly controlling the records. The XL have said, with the band, let's get rid of those special editions we never liked, with those B-sides, let's put the original albums back up there. But I think there might be some other special editions or bonus tracks coming in the future.
Yeah, so Spotify described it as a streamlining of the band's catalogue and stressed that all the core album catalogue remains available to the millions of fans on Spotify as before.
All the tracks you'd actually want to listen to.
Yeah.
So yes, it's not a dramatic Tom York taking a statement against streaming story, although actually probably a more interesting story. Warner did confirm, they wouldn't comment on this, but they did say, we can confirm that our negotiations with Impala and Merlin about allowing indies to represent some of the Parlophone catalogue, those negotiations are ongoing, they're going well, and we do anticipate some sort of announcement coming from Warner, Impala and Merlin together in the near future that will presumably announce a number of deals of these kinds where little chunks of the Parlophone catalogue will be represented moving forward by friendly, cuddly, independent labels that everyone knows and loves. Although, isn't Warner Music meant to be the friendly, cuddly major? Isn't that what people say?
Is it just because it's small?
I think it probably is just because it's small. I sort of sense that Radiohead did get on better with Warner since Warner got the Parlophone catalogue than they did with EMI when it was under Terra Firma management and then subsequently under Citigroup ownership. Although that didn't stop them suing Warner Music last year, albeit over stuff that happened back in the EMI days. But anyway, for fans of Radiohead B-sides, yeah, you can't stream them. Sorry. Interesting deal negotiations to compensate. CMU approved time now. Andy Malt will approve things. And if you like the sound of anything that Andy Malt approves in this section of the podcast, if you go to the website and there's a little game on our website at the moment. If you go to completemusicupdate.com, see if you can find the little Spotify logo. There is one there on the webpage, on the homepage. Have a good look. You'll find a little Spotify logo. And if you click on that, we will take you to the CMU approved playlist. Andy Malt has never approved a Radiohead B-side. He hates Radiohead B-sides. In fact, they are actively CMU disapproved.
Was Talk Show Host a B-side?
I've no idea.
I think it was, because I really like that.
But so you've never approved it in the CMU daily.
No, but it came out in like 1994.
But the fact there's no Radiohead B-sides is not a problem. And you can listen through the Spotify CMU approved playlist to the tracks we're talking about today and everything that we've approved since the start of the year. So all you have to do is find that Spotify logo on the CMU homepage. Good luck with that. Anna of the North.
Sounded like you were addressing Anna of the North then.
I don't know who Anna of the North is.
Well, she...
I have nothing to say to Anna of the North.
Wait, you just told her to find a Spotify logo.
Well, she should. I hope she's doing it right now. She could listen to her new single, well, she should.
Baby.
Well, she could listen to some. So, do you know what I was going to do then? I was going to say she could listen to and then name check one of the other things you've approved this week. But this is one of those weeks where I'm not sure I can pronounce any of the things you've approved, other than Anna of the North.
Anna of the North, who has been putting out tracks here and there for the last few years. They're quite good. This one, I think, is probably her best.
Yes, so do I. And I agree.
It preempts her European tour supporting Kygo. I think that's how you pronounce that.
Yeah, I'm going with Kygo.
I don't know. Anyway, yeah, this one, it's a bit brighter in tone than her previous singles, but remains quite icy and downbeat nonetheless. And what more could you ask for?
What more could you ask for? Okay, so here we go. Ophelia K.
Ophelia K. What was wrong with that?
Well, it's confusing because of the F, and obviously Shakespeareans like myself were expecting a TH for Ophelia. But, you know, Ophelia K.
You're not a Shakespearean.
No, it's true.
She's got a new single out.
She has.
From a forthcoming new EP. It's called Chinko. It's very good. It's sort of a step up in production and songwriting from her previous EP, which was also good, but this is better.
Better.
Well, it's very good. I think she could be a strong force in pop music.
And beyond the track you've approved, the EP when it comes out is going to be called?
I have no idea.
Oh.
Might be called, maybe it's called Chinko as well.
Maybe it is, and that would be the title track.
Yeah.
So who knows? Femme.
Mm-hmm.
Femme en fru is the next approved here.
Close enough.
On the CMU podcast.
Close enough. Femme en fru. I don't know. Anyway, they're Finnish.
Yeah, exactly. That explains that.
That's not a Finnish name.
No.
Anyway, they're an electronic duo from Finland. They've been around a few years. They sort of skirt around different electronic genres, but I think they'd probably be generally classed as like dark techno. Although this new single, Seer, is probably the closest to pop they're ever going to get.
Light techno?
I would not say it's light techno.
Illuminated techno?
Illuminated techno. No, it's still a bit dark, but it's quite poppy. It's a double A-side with another song that I have forgotten the name of.
So go check out at least one of those and maybe two. Ruxana Maurice. Is that what you're going with?
Yeah, good enough.
Yeah,
good
why enough. Not? Track's called Money, I can say that.
Yes, the track is called Money. It's a new single. She released an EP last year. This is the first single from maybe another EP or something. I don't know. She signed to Communion, which, you know, it's a good thing usually.
It is normally a good thing.
She borrows from a lot of genres from all over the place. It's like it's quite a weird mix.
Eclectic
is a word you might use.
It is a
use.
Word.
But then it's quite fashionable for the last God knows how long, 5 years at least, to kind of borrow from old music and then just make music that sounds like it's old. But she borrows from old music and then makes it sound new, which used to be a thing that people did, and then they all stopped. But that's what she's doing.
She's making it her own.
More of that, please.
CompleteMusicUpdate.com. CompleteMusicUpdate.com is the website. /approved is the thing that you need to put after the website. And actually, on every approved, you will find a link to the Spotify playlist. But it's much more fun to play the game. Go to the homepage and see if you can find the Spotify logo. And your prize, if you do, will be able to listen to all of those approved tracks and a load more.
The Mechanical Copyright Protection Society.
My favourite Copyright Protection Society.
MCPS.
The Mechanical Copyright Protection Society.
Is inviting third parties to pitch to administer certain aspects of its business.
Now, you've got a business degree.
I do.
You know how to use an Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah.
You're a king on Excel. You could do this. You could run all the administration for the UK's Mechanical Rights Collecting Society.
I could, but it sounds boring.
Just the name sounds quite boring, doesn't it? It's one of those things, isn't it? Is it the MCPS? It's a clumsy combination of letters. Is it just that in itself sounds quite boring, or is it because we know what it represents? But then I find copyright really fascinating. But there is something about MCPS that just sounds quite sleep-inducing. But there you go. But this is interesting! Don't be falling asleep, because this is interesting. So yes, MCPS are inviting third parties to come forward to take over the running of its operations. And it could be pretty much the entirety of MCPS's operations, or it might be a chunk of MCPS's operations. basically, the organisation has put out a brief and is welcoming submissions from other companies to take over chunks of the work, and they're sort of keeping their options very much open. There's a number of months that people have, well, a couple of months actually, it's the end of June, people have got to submit their proposals. And you really sense this is the MCPS reviewing everything that it does, how it does everything, keeping its options open, and at the end of the year, they might say, we're going to keep everything as it was, or they might say, we're going to do everything radically different, or I suspect it'll be a little bit of radically different and quite a lot of keeping things the same.
Yes, because MCPS has worked with PRS for how long now?
Since the late 1990s.
Since the late 1990s. The,
so, yes.
The MCPS-PRS Alliance.
Was its snappy name.
Equally, yeah, another clumsy collection of letters.
So, of course, copyright facts. We've talked about this before. There are various elements to the copyright. There are, amongst other things, the performing right and the mechanical right. And in publishing, it's quite common to separate the two and to license them separately. So it used to be in the UK that the publishers had two collecting societies. So if you were a music publisher, you would be in two separate collecting societies. So that when collective licensing applied, different societies would be involved, depending on whether or not it was the performing right of the copyright being exploited or the mechanical right. And PRS, the Performing Rights Society, represented the performing right. And MCPS, the Mechanical Copyright Protection Society, represented the mechanical right. So we had separate organisations, and as publishers, you had to join both. And there are various contractual reasons in terms of how songwriter contracts work in the UK as to why that makes sense. And publishers would be in both. Songwriters generally would only be in PRS unless they happen to be their own publisher, in which case they could join MCPS. But you're right, since the late 1990s, PRS and MCPS have actually worked very closely together, to the extent that a few years ago, they launched a joint venture business called PRS for Music. So to the outside world and to all of their licensees, they were basically one organisation. And that was quite useful, because once we started to shift into digital, you started to get an ever-increasing number of licensees who needed both the mechanical and the performing right at the same time. Because it used to be in the olden days that people either wanted to press and release CDs, in which case they needed a mechanical license, or they wanted to perform music live, or they wanted to broadcast music on the radio, in which case they needed a performing rights license. So they only needed a license from one society. The minute you start doing digital, certainly streaming, but actually downloads too, your licensees need both licenses at the same time. But by that point, PRS and MCPS were working together. They launched this joint venture business. So if you were an iTunes or you were a Spotify, you could actually get a joint license from MCPS PRS. You only needed to do one bit of paperwork. You paid over one chunk of money. Although, behind the scenes, PRS and MCPS remain separate. PRS is owned by its members, MCPS is owned by the Music Publishers Association, and any money that would come in, any download money or streaming money that would come in to the PRS for Music joint venture would then be split. And some of it would then go to PRS, some of it would then go to MCPS, and this is why digital licensing gets quite complicated. But the upside is the fact that MCPS and PRS worked so closely together meant that as a digital licensee, you didn't have to worry about the fact that there were two sets of rights being exploited here, the mechanical rights and the performing rights of the same song copyright, and therefore you only had to deal with one organisation. Then a few years ago, the joint venture, PRS for Music, ceased to be a joint venture. And rather than MCPS being a shareholder in PRS for Music, the joint venture, for various technical financial reasons, it sold its share to PRS. So PRS for Music, the business, is now owned by the Performing Rights Society, and MCPS is a client. So actually, day to day, it made no difference. As a licensee, you wouldn't have noticed the change. You still had a relationship with PRS for Music. That's who you paid the royalties to, etc., etc. However, there was a significant ownership change in that PRS for Music is now a subsidiary of PRS. MCPS is a separate organisation that employs the services of PRS, and that includes deal-making services, data management services, and all of the royalty admin accounting services that you're going to do on your spreadsheet once you win this contract. And this is now MCPS saying, well, we like working with PRS on our data and on our royalty collection and our deal-making, but perhaps there's something better out there.
Which is a good thing to do, I think.
And we don't have to work with PRS Music because we don't own them anymore. We've got no sort of shareholder reason to stay. And so if we can find a better solution, then we will go with the better solution. So as you say, I mean, I don't think the outcome of this will be this, but it could be. Yeah, it doesn't make sense, does it? but I don't think the outcome will be a complete divorce of MCPS and PRS. But in theory, that could be the outcome of the review that was announced this week.
So other than me,
And your spreadsheets.
Who else could run MCPS, or at least bits of it?
Well, I suppose if you split up the different bits of what MCPS does, or indeed what PRS currently does for MCPS, you've got the database bit, you've got the deal-making bit, and you've got the bit of crunching all the figures that come in from the services and divvying up the money and processing the money and paying the money. So you've got three different bits to it. In terms of the deal-making bit, anyone could do that. You just have to be a good negotiator, understand a bit of copyright law. So anybody could do the deal-making bit. Having said that, I think that is possibly the one bit that MCPS could actually take in-house. And MCPS itself could start doing the deal-making. MCPS is actually an incredibly small organisation because PRS does most of the work, but they hired Jane Dybel, formerly of Warner Chappell, a few years ago to run MCPS. Jane now runs the wider Music Publishers Association and its various subsidiaries. When Jane was back at Warner Chappell, she was very much involved in the deal making on the digital side. So it wouldn't surprise me if some of the deal making wasn't brought back in house. But anybody could do the deal making bit. When it comes to the database bit, and especially when it comes to the processing the royalties bit, that's quite a lot of hard work. And now I think about it, I'm not sure you and your spreadsheet is actually up to the job. I'm sorry. Now I've given that some proper consideration. I'm not sure. I mean, you pitch, by all means pitch. But I suspect that the only organisations that really could do it are other collecting societies. So other organisations like PRS. And the two obvious contenders are the two collecting societies that are privately owned. Most collecting societies are either owned by their members or they're owned by a trade organisation. But in the US, you've got CSAC, which is owned by private equity, and you've got AMRA, which is, as of last year, owned by Cobalt. And they are both really expanding what they do. CSAC originally was in the performing rights business, but it bought the Harry Fox Agency in the US, so it is very much now in the mechanical rights business. And AMRA have great ambitions to provide database services using the Cobalt database technology that everyone seems to love. So I think both AMRA and CSAC are potential people to pitch for this. MCPS say that people have approached them and expressed an interest before them are formally opening up, saying, oh, we're taking pictures. There have been expressions of interest, but I don't know from whom. Probably those two. Maybe some of the continental European societies. Who knows? But it will be interesting to see who comes forward, what sort of services they're offering, and whether or not. I think taking the deal-making back from PRS wouldn't really make any difference day to day. But if you take the database or the distribution stuff away from PRS, that does potentially have quite a significant impact on the collective licensing framework in Europe, and that would bring about a lot of changes, maybe some good stuff. There will be some challenges too, so it'll be interesting to see how this turns out.
The one thing we do know isn't going to happen is MCPS doing all the ab itself. Jane Dybel's made that very clear.
Yeah, she doesn't want to open up a spreadsheet.
She said they are not in the business of building pipes and machines.
No. And I've been to MCPS's offices. They're quite small. They're in the corner of the PRS. PRS have massive offices, and in the corner are MCPS offices. I can confirm you wouldn't get very many pipes and machines in that little corner of the building that MCPS belong to. So, yeah, they don't want to bring in all that admin in-house. They definitely want to outsource that to a PRS or to somebody else. As I say, the output of this could be that some of the deal-making comes back in. MCPS has a sister organisation called Impel, which represents when it comes to negotiating specifically with digital services. At the moment, PRS negotiates for Impel. I think the most likely output is that Impel will definitely start. I mean, this is me speculating wildly, but I can really see that Impel will take the deal-making element of what it does in-house, and that would then fall to MCPS and ultimately to Jane, I would imagine, unless they hire someone else to do the deal stuff. As for the admin, it's definitely not coming in-house. Jane Dybel has been very clear on that, but who will provide that? It will be quite interesting to see. Despite us kicking off this story by discussing how boring MCPS's name is, actually, this is quite an interesting story.
It's not often there's a big shake-up in collecting societies.
No.
And so, I mean, it may continue to be that way. There may be no shake-up at all. But the fact that there could be a shake-up
is
quite interesting.
What is also interesting is that collecting societies traditionally had their own territory. They generally just stayed in their own country. They were all mates with each other. They all have reciprocal agreements. You have BMI and ASCAP in the US competing for members. But generally, the societies didn't too much tread on each other's turf. And then what we've seen in the last 10 years is that starting to change. And the big societies really starting to compete. CSAC have really ramped up their efforts to get in more work. AMRA, Cobalt, really big change. And we are starting to see collecting societies that used to be best mates, reciprocal agreements, we love them, starting to compete much more head on. And something like this will likely see a number of societies much more competing head on for business. And That is interesting.
Just quickly, time to look at a few of the stories we haven't had time to talk about in depth. Firstly, going back to what we discussed last week about Tidal, it did confirm while we were recording the podcast,
as is always the way,
that they are suing the company's, well, Jay-Z's company is suing Tidal's former owners for misrepresenting how many users the streaming service actually had.
Well, they've put them on legal notice, which could pave the way for full-on litigation. So, yeah, that is likely a story we're going to come back to.
Also in legal news, Kesha has suffered another setback in her case against Dr. Luke, which is very confusing.
It is a very confusing story. I mean, we talked about it on the podcast a few weeks ago, and we tried to navigate our way around the story. So, yes, a summary judgment came out from the New York courts this week, in which a number of the claims made by Kesha's side were knocked back by the judge. The ruling is out there on the internet. We linked to it from our story on the website. And the judge attempted a summary of the story so far of the dispute between Kesha and the producer, Dr. Luke. It is a very long story, but if you are confused, because there are multiple elements to this case.
Well, that's the thing, is that the headlines this morning were all, this case has been dismissed, but that's not actually true.
No, because some significant portions of the case have been dismissed, but
the case exists in three different states.
For starters, yes. Yes.
And so in New York, most of it has been dismissed.
But, and there are multiple elements to it. There's the initial contractual squabble, there's Kesha's allegations against Dr. Luke, and there's some defamation litigation still going through the motions. And actually, potentially the big case is in California, and that case was put on hold because of all the stuff happening in New York. And that we could as yet see the Californian case get to court, and that could be where actually most of these arguments are properly looked into, particularly the allegations against Dr. Liu, which of course he has denied from the start. But a significant development nonetheless.
Some more legal news. Justin Bieber and Usher might have to go to court over a song theft accusation without a musicologist, which is a bit of a tricky point.
Yeah, because they missed a deadline.
Yeah. Well, they thought they hadn't missed a deadline. They had missed a deadline.
This is a long-running case that was actually dismissed and then restated on appeal last year, I think. And both sides were given a deadline in mid-March to get their expert testimonies written up and submitted to court, ready for any hearing that's going to take place later this year. Bieber's side picked up these bloody musicologists. Other than these cases, we've had said this before. Other than these cases, what do musicologists do? But the musicologist that Bieber's side wanted to use was too busy to meet the March
because
deadline.
They had a lot of other cases like this to work on.
The other side said, that's fine, we'll give you a couple of weeks, don't worry about it. But then the judge said, hang on a second, it's my deadline, not your deadline. I'm sticking to it. You didn't submit your expert testimony, so you can't have any. Which would make it quite odd for Bieber and Usher's side to fight the case. They're now saying, oh, please, please. Well, they were trying to say, weren't they? Because the judge refused to extend the extension on a number of things. And they're sort of saying, oh, well, clearly you didn't think about it when you did that.
You didn't mean to
let us bring our musicologist expert testimony. Although that's a bit patronising, isn't it? I wouldn't try and patronise a judge. I'd go for the, oh, we're really sorry. Please, 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 please. Let's put this through. But be interesting to see how that... Everything is interesting to see. It will be interesting to see how that develops.
It will, yes. And non-legal news, although, you know, it's a thing that could have ended up being legal news.
There could as yet be a criminal prosecution. With their heads.
Cat's Eyes gate-crashed Buckingham Palace to perform a song from their new album, which amazingly they managed to do.
And film it.
There's an interview in The Quietus about this. It was not the easiest thing to pull off, but they did. It follows, they did a similar thing in the Vatican last year, and then they were saying, in 2011, and then they were saying in this Quietus interview that since then, every interview they've done, they've gone like, well, what are you going to do next? You'd have to do Buckingham Palace next, so they thought they'd give it a go.
So what are they going to do next?
Who knows?
The Kremlin. I think that
might not be wise.
That's a challenge. I want to see the YouTube video of you performing in the Kremlin. I look forward to it.
But you can read more about that and watch the video and read all about those stories that we didn't have time to talk about in depth at the show notes for this show, completemusicupdate.com/podcast. They're all linked there. Go and have a look.
Now, we often talk a lot about copyright on this podcast.
Do we?
For which I apologise.
Yeah.
Trademark news! Another branch of intellectual property.
Who doesn't love some trademark infringement stories? And we have two.
Two bits of trademark infringement alleged their alleged trademark infringement. They are, well, certainly one of these is clearly a cheeky play on a pop star's trademark, whether or not it actually constitutes trademark infringement. Beyonce reckons it does.
Yeah, she's suing a company called Fiance Inc. That's Beyonce with an F instead of a B.
Who sell T-shirts and mugs and crap.
Yeah, they sell, yeah, stuff for people who've just got engaged and want to market by wearing a T-shirt and don't know how to spell Fiance. That's basically their business model. Particularly, Beyonce is upset that they produced a mug which says Fiance, he put a ring on it, which she reckons is quite brazenly. Brazenly was the word used, ripping off not only her name, but lyrics from single ladies.
Yes, so certainly not only are they using a name that clearly is a play on Beyonce, but by then using one of her lyrics as one of their slogans, it's like they're sort of fessing up, saying, yeah, this is totally a play on Beyonce. The question is, you know, does that constitute a trademark infringement? With trademarks, there's two elements to trademark, which is there is the intellectual property, you've invested in a brand, and therefore you should be rewarded element to trademark. And then there's also the sort of consumer confusion side of trademark. It's will people buy products thinking they're getting an official product when they're not? And trademark is there to protect consumers. To an extent, this is sort of taking the piss, isn't it? But it's taking the piss in a sort of amusing way. I mean, we can debate whether or not it's actually amusing. Parody rights don't generally apply to trademarks, because obviously there is a parody right under copyright. So I suspect if they tried to do them for copyright for taking the Beyonce lyric and putting it on a mug, you could probably defend that by saying, well, it's parody, and therefore you can't sue us for copyright infringement. But when it comes to trademark, the parody fair use exemption usually doesn't apply. So they may or may not be able to fight this one off.
It's intentional, fraudulent, malicious, willful and wanton.
Is that your opinion there?
No, that's what Beyonce's lawsuit
says.
That's
Beyonce's opinion. She's very pissed off about this. We already knew she was pissed off about this because she targeted one of the websites who were selling this stuff.
Well, Etsy, so anyone can sell stuff on Etsy, and someone was selling T-shirts.
Of course. And she issued a cease and desist against the site.
Yes.
And they responded to that, I think.
Yeah, they delisted it. I mean, we don't want to get sued.
So now she's going after
the
people.
But you can, if you Google Fiance, you can find lots of places selling these things. And I think there's other people other than this company selling them. But she's particularly gone after this company because they have tried to trademark both Fiance with and without an accent on the E.
So that's put them into a position that these are the people we should sue over these outrageous T-shirts and mugs. But not only Beyonce in our trademark dispute news this week.
No, Deadmau5. It's been a while since we've had a good Deadmau5 trademark infringement lawsuit.
Of course,
here comes one.
The best Deadmau5 trademark story was when he was having his squabble with Disney, wasn't
it? That was Disney suing him.
It was, but then he bounced back because there was so Disney was suing him on trademark, but then he found them infringing his copyright. So we had some backwards and forwards between Deadmau5 and Disney.
And then he sent a cease and desist to Deadmau5 the musical, which was a tiny fringe musical
about a mouse.
About a mouse.
And a mouse spelt properly.
Yeah.
In that case, although and clearly a play on Deadmau5. Although didn't he then sort of say, oh well, I'm happy with that now, I wasn't being an arsey trademark owner. Didn't he issue some sort of statement?
I don't remember.
Anyway, tell us why Deadmau5 is getting all trademark angry this week.
He's now suing a company called West Coast Vape Supply because they have a brand called Deadmods, which is a brand of e-cigarette and stuff, associated accessories, which not only is it called Deadmods, but the logo for it was very similar to his own.
And therefore very similar to the Disney logo.
No.
Given that they're all quite similar.
No, because it's different.
It's different. Of course it's different.
It's the word, not the mouse.
Oh, it's got the
no
word.
There's no mouse
oh,
involved.
I see. It's not the mouse.
No.
It's just how he writes Deadmau5. They'd written Deadmods in the same style of words.
Yeah.
You see.
But see,
I didn't look at the pictures.
On.
That's what my problem. Didn't look at the pictures.
You should always look at the pictures.
I should look at the pictures. I hope the judge looks at the pictures.
Yes. This has been going on a little while. So his lawyers have had various letters back and forth with this company, which prompted the company to redesign both that logo and its website.
But not change the name.
However, his lawyers are now saying that the fact that the company did that redesigning...
An admission of guilt!
It's an admission of guilt, yeah.
Woo! We love it when we get an admission of guilt.
So that will be interesting to see how
And
am
I right
out.
Saying they're still opposing the fact that the name is relatively similar, plus they're saying, although you redesigned the logo, A, that's an admission of guilt, and B, you didn't redesign it enough.
Yes.
We want it in Comic Sans and nothing else. Otherwise, we still think there's a case for trademark infringement.
Yes, although the company says that it's just trademark bullying.
It is. Trademark.
Which is apparently a thing.
Bullying. A classic example of trademark bullying. We love a bit of trademark bullying, so hey, pop stars, try and do some more trademark bullying this week, and perhaps we can make this a regular feature. Pop stars bully over their trademarks.
Yeah, which artist would you like to rip off, and how would you do it? Why don't you let us know at CMU on Twitter?
And actually, if you could do it, and then hopefully they will then issue a cease and desist, and that generates more stories for this new regular slot on the CMU podcast.
Yeah.
So please get on the social networks now. And don't just say that you would like to do it. Actually do it. Get it all mocked up, and then we'll have something to talk about on next week's podcast.
Speaking of, you know, we asked how much people would pay for meet and greets with us.
Well, I do vaguely remember that, yeah.
A couple of weeks ago. I was offered £3.
£3?
I'm not sure if that was each or to split between us.
Oh, to split between us. Oh, it was for both of us. Or just one of us?
I don't know, maybe it was just me. No, I'll take the £3
you
myself.
Take the £3.
No one wants to meet you.
For yourself. I'm still available for the price of a steak dinner. And I'm not fussy. A cheap steak dinner will do. So, you know where I am?
Yes, I know where you are right now, but I'm not buying you a steak dinner.
Oh, I was looking forward. I thought the conclusion of that, that sentence was going to be, let's go and have a steak dinner, it's on
no,
me.
No.
Oh, well.
What a shame.
What a shame.
Anyway, I would tell you to subscribe to this podcast, but I'm sure you're already subscribed, so...
I'm not, actually.
I was talking to the listener.
I will subscribe this week. Buy me a steak dinner and I'll subscribe.
No. Dear the listener, not Chris Cook, who is not subscribed, I'm sure you're already subscribed, so why don't you take someone's phone, maybe even Chris Cook's, and just subscribe them to the podcast.
Well, if you buy me a steak dinner while I go to the toilet, you can have my phone and do what you like with it.
Well, watch out for that then. This podcast was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. Standing in for Matt Peaty at the controls this week is Charlie Brandon King. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
The end.